Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 32, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
And me, Ravi Abbott.
And here we are, episode number 32. We've been in the show 8 months now.
That's insane. We're dedicated, aren't we, Dan? You know, every Friday.
4 months, it'll be an entire year.
Wow.
We've done the Retro Hour. So, guys, we really appreciate you tuning into the show every single week. We are still loving doing the show as well. And judging by the iTunes reviews this week, you're still loving listening to it as well.
Yeah, we've had about 5 or 6 new ones. So if you can keep adding to them, it'd be great because you've always got some kind words to say on iTunes.
And it all helps in the grand scheme of things, obviously.
Totally.
Now, maybe you've just found us on iTunes recently. The show comes out every Friday. Ravi and I run through the big stories that have been making the headlines in the world of retro. And then in the second half of the show, we hand over to a very special guest. Now, I think it's fair to say the guest that we've got on this week has probably dealt with some of the biggest names in the world of media.
Totally. This guy, David Fox, he founded LucasArts Games, which is basically the gaming division for George Lucas. So, you know, this is massive. All the old games, Zap McCracken, you remember that?
Labyrinth game as well he worked on, didn't he?
Yeah, the Scum Engine.
Well, this guy was in there. I mean, you know, he was one of the founders of the of Lucasfilm Games. He was there pretty much from day one, really, wasn't he?
Yeah.
When it started. And we've got some amazing stories coming up. Him playing video games with George Lucas, who it turns out was actually a bit of an avid game designer, actually. He was pretty good at it.
Yeah, and so was Spielberg as well.
Now, you've got to hang around because we're going to hear the story about Spielberg's special custom hack for the Star Wars arcade game.
Oh, yeah. And of course it's going to be Star Wars themed.
Yeah, absolutely. So he's going to be on the Retro Hour in around half an hour from now. Just before we get into the stories this week as well, if you haven't liked our Facebook page, I think we're up to nearly 700 fans on there now.
Yeah, we should be getting more though. We get more listens than that.
Absolutely. So if you haven't liked us on Facebook yet, links are on the website, theretrohour.com, or just search for the Retro Hour podcast. We post loads of stuff in there during the week, loads of nice memories.
Yeah, there was that good one about zip drives. I'd totally forgotten about zip drives, and actually, I think I've got one at work in the basement somewhere, and this image you posted up just reminded me of it.
What they have, like, was it 100 megabytes per disc or something?
Oh, it used to be 30 meg.
Was it? Not even 100?
Yeah.
But I remember you'd always get the click of death on them as well.
They didn't last very long. I don't remember that, no.
Oh, they were very unreliable. Still look very cool, though.
I only had one.
So if you'd like to join us on Facebook and reminisce about such nerdiness as zip drives, then the Retro Hour podcast, give us a search and like the page. Right then, into this week's stories, and we're going to start with a bit of drama.
Yeah, this is hopefully not going to be Coleco Part 2, but we've got another Kickstarter that's running into a bit of controversy.
Another crowdfunder gone wrong, you could say. Now, this is the Sinclair ZX Spectrum Vega Plus. Now, we mentioned this when it originally got announced back in, like, must have been January, February, months ago. And they actually raised a lot. It was on Indiegogo they did this, and they raised £417,000 towards this project, which I think is about 3 times more than they initially wanted.
It was everywhere, wasn't it? And because it was backed by Clive Sinclair as well, which, you know, in all the papers, I literally couldn't see any other news articles apart from Vega Plus, Vega Plus.
Because there was like 3 like of these kind of Spectrum clones that came out at the same time, pretty much, and this was the only one that got the official Clive Sinclair endorsement, wasn't it?
Yeah.
However,
and the Vega before had been successful as well, so this is a follow-on from a successful project.
Things have gone a bit wrong, though, in the last couple of days by the looks of things. Now, there was a couple of guys who were involved in this, 2 former directors, Paul Andrews and Chris Smith. Now, from what we can tell, I mean, this story is literally just broken about, 10 minutes before we started recording
tonight?
Yeah,
we're recording this on Wednesday, so the landscape could be totally different by Friday.
Now, so what's essentially happened from what we can gather is they've accused the company.
These are the 2 directors.
Yeah. They're saying that this company, Retro Games Limited, had not been answering crowdfunders' inquiries as to, you know, kind of details on the product and when it's going to come out and specification and that kind of thing. And they're basically accusing them of not having good communication. And they said that they can't work with that. And now they're publicly distancing themselves from this project. So apparently they quit back in like April, but still held some shares in the company,
yeah,
I believe.
They still hold a 50% share. So, you know,
which is interesting in itself. Mm. And now the company are saying, in fact, this is not the case at all, and the reason they're going is to set up a rival company.
Oh, God, this just has the kind of, you know, beginnings of of a disaster. And I really hope it doesn't, because the Vega Plus looked really nice. And when's it meant to be out, Dan, isn't it?
Well, it's meant to be out next month.
Next month, so, okay, so...
It was meant to be out in September, and I think it was, like, going to sell for £100. So, obviously, I mean, you think if they're going to be releasing these in, like, 4 weeks, they must be going into production about now.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's what he was saying. These directors were saying, you know, we won't get the right information about product status mm-hmm. and stuff, but we never know what's going on behind the scenes, Dan. So.
You know what, though? It all just seems a bit tacky. You know, and they're publicly throwing muck at each
other.
Yeah,
like, yeah. You're washing your dirty clothes in public. It's not good.
Yeah, not good at all, is it? And I think, you know, we've said before that the retro gaming industry really does rely on, like, crowdfunding these days. And, you know, it's just sad when stuff like this happens, because I think it puts people off getting behind these projects. But, I mean, like I said, the story literally has just broken tonight, so anything can change.
So, yeah, exactly. So we'll keep an eye on that one, guys.
We absolutely will. If you put money in, then, you know, fingers crossed it all works out for you. Now, this is pretty cool, because I think pretty much everyone I know has got a Raspberry Pi or two lurking around in a drawer, half of them unused. People buy them and think, oh, what am I going to do with it?
Well, I'd buy it, upgrade to the next model, and, you know, I've got all the old ones there still.
Yeah, so. I've got about four now, I think, lurking around. But if you want to do Amiga emulation on it, now there's been something really cool that's come out this week, and you've been trying this. It's called Ambien.
Ambien, yeah. This is a build that you can get, and it's basically... like, you know, a Linux build like Debian or, you know, Ambien, the Amiga version of that. And it's actually running on a Raspberry Pi 3. It's the equivalent of, say, an Amiga 4000 with an 040.
Oh, nice.
Or maybe an 060 if you push it a bit. But this is a seamless layer of emulation. So, because it's Linux, I don't know if you remember, there was a program called K-Lite years ago that came out with Amiga OS XL. This is some really geeky stuff, guys, you probably won't realize. But that allowed you to boot into the Amiga operating system natively without any kind of Windows background stuff and text. And this does exactly that.
So you put this on an SD card, image it, put it into your Raspberry Pi, and then it boots as if it's an Amiga, straight
as
into the Amiga.
As if it's an Amiga, straight into an emulated environment. And, you know, you can do all your Amiga stuff, providing you've got all the right setup and ROMs and stuff like that.
I mean, you can buy the ROMs from Cloanto. They do the set, you know, off the Android Play Store. You can get it for like £3 or £4, so not very much.
Yeah, it's the Amiga Forever Essentials, isn't it?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is awesome, because I've got original Amiga machines, as I know you have as well, but I think something like this, a Raspberry Pi, is so small. If you want to take it around a friend's house and play games and that kind of thing, and having a machine that boots straight into it, because it kind of takes you out of the experience a bit, seeing, like, you know, an Ubuntu loading screen or having a Windows desktop and having to click it.
But also, you know, Raspberry Pis are designed to be left on forever. So if I left my 4000 on, I'd have no house, because it would just burn down within a week or a few days. So.
A crusty old power supply.
Yeah. but a Raspberry Pi, you can just leave there doing all your rendering or whatever.
Well, I'm going to get this set up, and hopefully I'm going to try and get a video made this week about it, because I haven't done a video for a couple of weeks.
Oh, yeah, let's see if it turns into a headache or not.
Well, from what you've said, though, it's a pretty seamless environment. I mean, it is very early days. It's only just come out, hasn't it, in the last week or so?
Yeah, yeah. So this is a really cool idea. And I'm sure there was a Ross Broadway, and there was a few attempts at Raspberry Pi ones, but this one's really got it right.
And I think the AROS one, you had to be like a registered user or something to get it, but anyone can download this and it's free. Yeah. So we'll pop links in the show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, obviously, everyone's been going wild about this mini NES that Nintendo announced that's coming out a bit later on this year. Now, one guy's actually made his own version of it that a lot of people are saying is even better than the real thing. And again, it's based on the Raspberry Pi.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of articles where people are basically going, this is what Nintendo should be doing, not this new system. This guy's beat them, you know.
Well, looking at it, I mean, it is essentially a Raspberry Pi in a mini NES case with a controller. And I think the only real difference is that, obviously, you know, you can load your own emulator onto it. So rather than, you know, the mini NES that's coming out that Nintendo are releasing, what, there's like 60 games on that?
Yeah.
And that's it. They're not going to add any more to it, and they can't. But with this, I mean, with it just being basically an emulation box, you can put as many as you want on.
Well, it could be a retro. You could put RetroPie on there.
You can emulate more than Nintendo if you want to. But it's got a 3D printed case, which I think, you know, he's done a really good job on the case.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
It does look awesome. But I think kind of the gimmick that everyone's going wild about, which I'm not overly struck by, if I'm honest, is the fact that it uses mini cartridges that are also 3D printed.
They're using NFC, aren't they? So it's a It's like when you swipe your phone on the chip and pin thing. It just kind of registers it. It's not really an actual game information stored on there, is there?
No, from what I've read, you know, literally it's these NFC cards. You put it in and there's an NFC reader on the GPIO port on the Pi. So it'll just tell the emulator to load this ROM.
Off that little cart, yeah.
No, load it off the actual SD card that's in the Raspberry Pi. Okay, this just tells it what to load.
Yeah,
when you put the cart in, it's like, okay. Oh, right, load that ROM. So there's nothing on the actual cards themselves. And apparently they cost $6 to make.
$6 to make, oh God. So how much would they cost to actually mass produce? And so, you know, if
But someone pointed this out on Reddit today. They put, you know, you could buy the game off the Wii Virtual Store for, like, you know, half the price. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Bit of a gimmick. And, you know, I think fair play to the guy, you know, for a little homebrew project. It's pretty cool, but, you know, I can't see that it's anything Nintendo got to fear.
No, and I don't know what the hardware is going to be like behind the Nintendo one, so it could actually be do a nicer job of creating the NES games than a Raspberry Pi emulator.
Well, you mentioned that. I was actually reading an article today, and they were talking about one of the marketing people from Nintendo Canada had done an interview on the radio over there. I think it was yesterday. And she spoke a bit more about the details of the new Nintendo NES. And she's saying apparently it comes with like some kind of CRT emulation.
Oh, like scan lines.
Yeah, and it kind of smooths the pixels out and stuff when you use it via HDMI to give it a more authentic look, apparently, which is good news.
Yeah, so, totally. Let's hope that it's much better than this Raspberry Pi one.
But I think, you know, fair play to the guy for doing a little homebrew project, but yeah, I don't know why everyone's going wild over it, all the papers and stuff,
do
and
I.
New sites. Like, come on. Now, this is kind of cool. You know, there are companies that ruled the world at one time, and then where are they now?
Yeah, there's a lot, and the internet was initially a big kind of flashpan for that. It was the destroyer of companies, wasn't it?
Well, the dot-com
the
boom, wasn't
one,
it?
Yeah.
Well, there is an article here on NPR, and it's titled "The Big Brands of the 90s, The Big Internet Brands of the 90s, Where Are They Now?" I'd actually forgotten that Verizon had bought so many of these kind of old names. Obviously, they're buying Yahoo at the moment for $4.8 billion.
Wow.
Which sounds a lot for Yahoo. Like, what do Yahoo own these? They got Tumblr and Flickr, and what else?
That's it, yeah.
Yahoo Mail.
GeoCities.
I think they do own that, actually, yeah. But I can't imagine it's worth $4.8 billion. And they bought AOL as well last year. So it seems Verizon are on a bit of a mission to kind of pick up all of these, you know, ancient giants.
Mm.
But also it mentions a few of these other companies. Now, any interesting ones that you've seen on this list?
Angel Fire. I've not heard that name for years, and it says they're still around.
They were a make-your-own website, like GeoCities.
Yeah, I had my own little domain on Angel Fire. Everyone used to have their own little HTML site, and they'd put GIFs in there and code it.
Under construction GIFs.
Yeah.
Well, some other ones as well. ICQ apparently was sold for $188 million in 2010.
What? This is madness. I wish I'd made a like crap piece of software back then. This is crazy. And Netscape.
There you go.
And Netscape, of course. Netscape did their revenge, which was with the big Microsoft court case.
Yeah.
Where they got accused of doing a monopoly by packaging Internet Explorer with the operating system. They destroyed Netscape, but Netscape came back with the Mozilla Foundation.
And it open source and everything.
Open source and destroyed Internet Explorer. Now it's Microsoft Edge, isn't it? So,
and did you know what Mozilla stands for?
No, not at all.
Well, do you remember an old web browser called Mosaic?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It stands for Mosaic Killer.
Ah,
I never knew that. Yeah, I'd read that the other day. I was like, oh, that's interesting.
The only reason I know about Mosaic was because that's what Kevin Mitnick would do all his naughty stuff like.
But it is cool, though, to kind of look back. And there's so many of these brands as well that you look at. Like, you know, Ask Jeeves and stuff like that. You think, God, I remember, like, my mum used to use that because Alta Vista was a bit too complicated.
I was a dedicated Alta Vista guy.
I used to love Alta Vista. It was awesome.
Do you remember the crack version, Hasta La Vista?
Yeah, to get the cereals off and stuff. I do remember that. Well, that might even still be around. But probably. I remember you'd have to go on that and, like, close all the pop-ups and stuff and bring up and everything, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it is cool to have a little look back. Because, I mean, you think, you know, these were only, like, a decade or 15 years ago, but it seems like such ancient history now, doesn't it?
And, you know, it's the war with the search engines. It's kind of like the one that gets used the most is going to win, basically, because it has more results. So.
It's crazy though, back then, you know, how quickly it would all change, because Yahoo was obviously the big player originally, then yeah. Alta Vista came along, and there was a few kind of battled it out in the early 2000s before Google really took over, I think.
Well, there was that argument with Alta Vista, that Alta Vista was the real search engine because it did the meta results.
Yeah.
And Google and Yahoo were created search engines.
Yeah, their own index.
Where they indexed it and they picked it, and it wasn't a true search.
Well, I remember this one called alltheweb.com. I used to like that one, and that said, you know, not just some of the web, all of the web. And they had like a spider. It was got a web spider that would crawl out and look at stuff.
Do you remember the real-time searches that they used to do on? They don't do that anymore. The real-time Twitter searches you could do on early Google and stuff like that.
Oh, when Twitter first came around. Yeah.
That was really good.
So I do remember that the last real rival that I remember hearing about was, remember Cool? C-U-I-L? In about 2008, 2009, was a group of ex-Google employees went to form this new company. And I remember like Leo Laporte was going crazy about them this week in tech. They're going to be the next big thing. And like, actually, I do remember at the time, a lot of people thought that they were going to topple Google around maybe 2007, maybe looking at about, you know, 9-10 years ago now. But it had like a black background.
Yeah.
And it was quite, you know, it looked quite modern with graphics not in the background. You could change it. But I was thinking about it recently and I looked at the domain. It was actually for sale. So I thought, no one's going
to look at that. Bing as well. It's quite popular in America, isn't it? But it doesn't seem to be around these parts.
The only people I know that go on Bing is to look at rude videos. I've heard they're pretty good for that. But, not that I know, obviously.
No. Only people I know is when they open Internet Explorer and it's default as their search.
Yeah,
search the word Google.
To search for Google Chrome and download it quickly, yeah. So if you want to have a little bit of reminiscing about these old internet brands, you'll find this article. We'll stick it in the show notes at theretrohour.com. Archive.org are a great website, and we've had a little article here submitted by Graeme Lacey. Thank you for getting in touch. Now, this is archive.org. I've added over 10,365 Amiga titles to its ever-growing list of software.
Wow.
You know, we mentioned that you can play some of their games in a browser.
Yeah.
Apparently, you can play 1,351 of these available right now. Some of them are just demos as well, because they're trying to get around copyright and stuff as well. But you look through it, I mean, they've got the Amiga Tosec on there, haven't they, already, which is like, and they've got one for the Atari ST. Loads of systems as well, where you can literally just download a massive zip file. I think the Atari ST one, I looked at that, it's something like 80 or 90 gigabytes or something of, like, you know, just disk images.
It's crazy because it's just like, I never thought in my life I could download a complete collection of a game system. I never thought anyone would even make one, you know.
Dude, you look back, you know, 10, 15 years ago, downloading an MP3 took you 20 minutes, let alone downloading like nearly 100 gigabytes of files.
And the funny thing about this is as well, because of course they're all not legitimate copies, they're all pirate copies. Every version's cracked.
But it's the thing about archive.org, I mean, well, the Tosec project, they aim to do, you know, if you ever look at it and you want to play like a bit of software or a game on there, they have about 20 different versions of all the different cracked throws and everything, don't they? So it really is an effort to preserve this software. And at the moment, though, you can play over 1,000 of these Amiga games, apparently, in an emulation layer called JS MAME, which means you can actually just play it on your web browser.
So I guess that's through Java.
JavaScript, I guess, yeah. So,
well, you know, the one fear that we all have as retro owners is that favourite website that you go on every week is just going to go down one day and never return with all that software that's essential to you. So this is great, you know. And also, bit of advice, have your own personal little backup archive as well. That's what I do.
If, like, you know, if Aminet or something vanished one day, you'd be like, where do I get everything from now? You know what I mean?
I know a guy who's got a mirror going on at the moment. So
well, the day, it's only like 80 gigabytes, apparently. So
yeah.
I could stick that on a USB drive.
Yeah, he's got it on his hard drive.
Yeah, it's crazy, though, isn't it? But I think archive.org is such a great project, though. And it's a website that, you know, these guys are not only, they started archiving the web. Now they seem to be trying to archive like every bit of computer software ever made. So it's a pretty beastly project, isn't it? Now, they're bringing the internet to rural America in quite an interesting and quite retro way.
Yeah. So I've been reading this article in New York Times, and it starts off really nicely. From the sofa in his living room, Clinton Creason can see the electric pole outside that his father staked there 70 years ago to bring power to the remote area.
You should do a movie trailer.
Yeah. So basically, you know, they're doing co-ops and electric co-ops, which is the way that they originally bought electricity to the rural areas of America. People in the kind of town or the village would say, right, we all want to get this electricity. So let's put
newfangled thing.
Yeah, let's put a load of money together and actually pay for the telecom lines to be installed and the lines to be put in.
this community have got together and decided, look, we all want fast internet. And I love this quote here. The cooperative is doing it again, but now, this time, the light bulb is the internet. Which is great, though, because it's 120 residents here who've actually paid an internet provider to sling fibre cable for miles to reach their little village. That's awesome, though, isn't it? And I think, you know, of course, America's such a massive country as well. And there's got to be, you wonder how much of the country has still got, I mean, he said this is a 70-year-old phone pole that was there.
Yeah, and there's going to be such remote rural areas, and you know, there's no way that you're going to be able to get the net out of there. I don't know. How would you do it, Dan?
Well, you know what? It's actually a bit depressing, this, because they've managed to get this to, like, you know, the deepest, darkest parts of, like, the desert or whatever, yeah? And I've got a mate who's just moved outside Leicester. Like, literally, he can only get 1 megabyte.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it's, the phone lines are that old. And he's looking at, like, satellite internet and all sorts, because he lives just slightly out in the countryside, only about, like, 3 miles away, though.
The worst thing is, right, this is the... I'd say, I don't know what the difference with America is, because I was listening to Leo Laporte years ago, and he was getting a T1 line installed, and he was getting it all from the phone company and everything. But here, it's all about the junction box. So I lived in a modern building that was beautifully done up, but they put a copper box in there. I could only get 1 meg. And that was in the city centre. I had Crytek underneath me developing the Cry engine.
And I was sitting there with... as well. No one took that game for ages to come out.
Yeah. It was crazy.
It's, well, actually, I had the same thing. Before I live where I did now, I was in like a new estate that got built, and it was exactly the same there. I think my ISP was BT I was with. I couldn't get like Virgin or anything like that. But I heard... A friend of mine who worked for Virgin at the time told me this. In the late 90s and early 2000s, the government kind of, you know, give a lot of money to, we're getting a bit off the topic of the America one here, but into Britain, they kind of funded the rollout of cable. You know, on the early cable
companies.
Yeah, there
was this mass Get Everybody Connected program.
Yeah, and that was like, you know, Diamond were the early companies, and even before NTL and that kind of thing. We had Comcast, where I lived, Comcast UK, that eventually was bought out by NTL. But then I think the government stopped funding that around 2000, 2001. So then anything that was kind of built in the 10 years after that didn't get any, like, cable laid down.
Well, there's also these cheap little nasty companies. Not nasty, but the way that they're delivering internet isn't the best way, which is... like Plusnet, that basically use the old copper lines and advertise, we're using the old copper lines, but it's dirt cheap. So, you know, you can get internet basic for your granny and go online, but it's not helping the infrastructure at all develop.
Well, I think, you know, because I remember NTL, like, struggled for a long time, and, like, they kept running out of money and everything, so they weren't putting any money into laying new new cable, which is why so many new estates are still on, like, this crap thing. But then you look at this and, you know, it's, I remember... I tried to get, you know, fibre in this place where I lived, and they kind of said to me, oh, if you get all your neighbours together and all that. But, you know, I met my neighbours maybe twice. I wasn't like a little rural village where everyone's best buds and all that. So,
well, maybe we could get a fibre cable and drag it to your mate's house.
But I think good on this little community, though, you know, getting themselves connected to the world and doing it together. So,
yeah, if the government's not doing it, then sort it yourself. It's
exactly.
Good.
Right then, guys, thank you so much for checking out episode number 32 of The Retro Hour. We will be out again next Friday from our website, theretrohour.com. All your favourite podcast clients, YouTube as well. And, of course, as we mentioned before, give us a follow on Facebook and Twitter. We're on there as well.
Yeah. And just give us a tweet and everything.
And also, if you spot any stories in the week, we always love getting stuff off you. Shout out to Colin, who got in touch with a few stories this week as well.
Yeah, from Let's Play Retro.
Thank you very much for that, Colin. Right then, for the next half an hour, here he is then, the main event. The guy who was right there at the start. Lucasfilm Games we're going to talk about now. Labyrinth, Zack McCracken, The Scum Engine, George Lucas, Steven Spielberg. For the next half an hour on The Retro Hour, David Fox. And we'll catch you next Friday.
Ciao.
Well, welcome to the podcast, David.
Thank you.
So let's get your history right from the beginning. That'd be interesting. And we'd love to find out, what was your first experience with a computer then?
Ooh, well, first experience with a computer was when I was in high school, which was in the late 1960s. And I got permission to go to the local junior college and take a computer programming class. And we were at that class, they were using, I can't remember, it was either paper tape or punch cards. So it was not a very interactive experience. And I liked the idea of figuring stuff out, but I hated the delay in feedback, where you write the program, You submit it to the operator. They come back and give you all the syntax errors the next day. You fix the errors, hopefully, resubmit it. Then you start getting logic errors. And, you know, why is it not working? And you have to go back and look at the code. And it was basically a 1 or 2 day turnaround each time there was an iteration. And that was just hellacious. I hated that.
It sounds quite a long process.
Yeah, so I said, okay, this is not for me. I'm not going to be an engineer. I'm not going to do programming. And I switched to psychology. And it wasn't really until maybe 7 or 8 years later, it was in 1976, when my wife and I decided that we wanted to open a nonprofit public access microcomputer center, because microcomputers had just started coming out. Then we got computers. Then we got funding to do the center. We opened it up with 10 microcomputers, and those were way more fun to use because they had a CRT on them and a keyboard, and they were all local, and, you know, programming was much more fun.
Were you initially really excited then using computers and wanted to get more people to access them?
Yeah, well, I think we saw, the truth was, I was looking around that time, around 1976, I was looking long term about what I really wanted to be doing. And I was actually thinking of something way beyond what you could do at present time. And it was more like equivalent to an immersive interactive theme park. And which is a far cry from what the technology was at the time. But the idea of being able to go to a place like Disneyland, which, you know, I grew up with. I lived in Los Angeles. That's where I grew up. But instead of having the same experience every time you went on the ride, it would be totally different and immersive, and you'd feel like you were there. It's really, you know, at least some aspects of what virtual reality would be now, except, you know, probably beyond that. There's a book series called Dream Park that came out in the early 80s, I think, that was really close to what I was imagining. But this is, you know, I was thinking about this earlier than that. So I figure, okay, if I don't know anything about computers really, if that's where I want to end up, what do I have to do to start? And we kind of broke it down and came up with this public access center where I could, you know, learn programming, teach programming to other kids. My wife was a teacher, so I taught her programming, and she did most of the classes. We'd have field trips of kids coming in from schools and for birthday parties, and they'd rent time on the computers for like $1.50 an hour. And we had a bunch of games. It eventually ended up with like 40 or so computers, including Apple IIs and Atari 800s and 400s, Commodore PET, Radio Shack computer, TRS-80, and a couple of CPM systems. And for most of the kids that came, this was their first experience ever seeing or touching a computer. They were just, for most families, they were just too expensive or not really practical. I mean, basically, at the time, if you wanted to do something on a computer, you either had to write the program yourself or see if you could find a game you liked. And there wasn't a huge amount of software available at the time.
So for you, was it more the entertainment side of computing then that interested you? Was it like digital games that you were most interested in?
Yeah, well, because that was, you know, that was the path towards an interactive Disneyland type experience would be in the area of gaming. We actually thought that the computer center would be much more about business use. When we were looking at which computers we were going to purchase initially, even though my heart was with gaming, I don't want to lock down where I thought the usage was going to be. So when I was looking at the computers, we saw one which was called a processor technology Sol 20, which was based on 8080 CPU and had a black and white monitor you plug into it. It had a really nice keyboard with upper and lower case text and walnut wooden sides to it, which my wife really liked. And the other one we looked at was the Apple II, which had just come out or was just about to come out. And I actually went down to, you know, the Sunnyvale area and got a demo of the early Apple II by these two guys with really scraggly long hair and beards and stuff. And they were really proud of it. And but when I found out that there was no upper and lower case, even though it was in color and it had sound, I just thought it wasn't going to work for the business use that people thought were going to come into the center. So that was the two Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs giving me the demo. I had no idea who they were, of course. And we chose not to go with the Apple II at that point until later when they ended up with the ability to do upper and lowercase.
What were they like when you met them then at that time?
They were both really enthusiastic, and it was a sales pitch. I mean, it was the small office-like space with, you know, dozens and dozens of Apple II shelves and computers stacked on desks. And, you know, they were showing off their baby. And so it was, I was impressed. It just that, I just think that was for our use. I thought it was a fatal error. I was wrong. I mean, if we had gone with that, it probably would have been a better choice because we spent so much time. I mean, it had BASIC built into it. We spent so much time having to load BASIC off of cassette tapes into our Sol 20s. And if someone would walk up to one of them and give it a little shock, static electricity shock, it'd blow the memory out and you'd have to start over again. And the fact that most of the usage turned out to be gaming instead of what I thought would be business stuff, that would have been a lot easier too. So that was a mistake. Cost-wise, they're probably in the ballpark. They're probably somewhat equivalent, especially if you've gotten a bunch. So it was one regret from way back.
Did you eventually kind of, did you believe that everyone would have a computer in their own home? Yeah. By then, or was that beyond you?
We were way overly optimistic. We figured that in 5 years, everyone would have a computer. And, you know, it probably took, you know, 10 or 15 or 20. It took longer. I think by the time I stopped, we did the center for about 4 or 5 years. It went on beyond, after we left, I think it went for another 3 or 4 years, where the students who were helping run it took it over for us. By the time we left, everyone, all the field trips that came in, everyone had already touched a computer. Most still didn't have one in their house, but schools were at least getting them, so there was access.
Well, you were in a great position because you managed to get a job with Lucasfilms and Atari, which were both probably the biggest entertainment companies in the world.
I never actually worked for Atari. We, because of the computer center, we were kind of tied into them. We got some grants, and Atari donated a bunch of computers to us. Chris Crawford, who was an evangelist at the time for Atari, would come out and give some talks at computer club meetings we had, and got access to information about the workings of the computer, which is how I ended up, you know, that happened when I was working on my computer animation book that I did in the early 80s. Because the book had two aspects, one was, you know, looking at high-end computer animation, I got access to the computer division at Lucasfilm and got to meet the people there and interview them, and, you know, they show me the demos of the things they were working on at the time, and I was able to include a bunch of photos and actually animation in the book. One of the heads of the group, Alvy Ray Smith, ended up proofreading my book for me, offered to do that to make sure it's technically accurate for at least the computer, high-end computer stuff. And the second half of the book was really a tutorial on how to use the Atari 800 to do computer animation at a low level. And so I had access to a lot of information in the workings of the Atari chips and talking to the Atari people and all that. And at around the same time that I finished the book is when I heard through one of our computer center members who happened to work at Industrial Light and Magic that Lucasfilm was going to start a games group. And I was able to, because of the contacts I made while I was working on the book, I was able to call up Ed Catmull, who is the head of the computer division, and say, I heard about this. I would love to interview for that. And I ended up, I think we had just hired Peter Langston, who was going to be the head of the group. But he hadn't started yet. So as soon as he came in to start, I was like one of the first people he interviewed and was really the first person he hired, other than a guy named Rob Poor, who was already a member of the computer division and wanted to switch over to our group instead of what he was doing. So I got in right at the beginning.
Well, you know, in those early days of Lucasfilm Games, what kind of involvement did George Lucas have at all, if any?
Not very much. He knew that he wanted to have people working on games because he knew that at some point the difference between games and movies would kind of end up being next to nothing. I mean, the quality of the animation, the quality, I knew that the graphics and the imagery and everything would reach such a high level that it'd be hard to tell the difference. But in terms of day-to-day operation, it was pretty much hands-off. When we started, they were still in production on Return of the Jedi, and that's where all his attention really was. And when the first two games were ready to be shown, which my game was Rescue on Fractalus and Dave Levine's game was Ballblazer, George came in for a demo while we were pretty early, maybe alpha or beta in terms of where we were with the games, and spent about 20 minutes or so with each of us, and gave him the joystick, he played the game, and it gave me some really good feedback. I mean, there are a couple of things, choices I had made, which were naive in terms of game design, which he kind of pointed out to me. And, it was asking why I was making these choices. And one was to not include a fire button because I wanted to avoid shooting. And this is my pacifistic tendencies coming out. I just wanted to force you to have the enemy crash into walls by having them follow closely behind you, which was just not really practical. So he asked for a fire button, and he also had the great idea of creating a tension point where the aliens, the pilots who you're picking up every once in a while would be an alien instead of a pilot, and they'd have this moment where one of them pops up and starts smashing on the glass. And I think he had exactly what it would look like, but his idea of creating tension and doubt and everything in the game was probably what made it really memorable for most people. I mean, I still get people who write to me and tell me the first time that they have one of the Jaggy monsters popping up and the reaction to that.
I think it's great that he had a bit of a natural flair for game design then, even though he didn't have much involvement in it before.
Well, he had a natural flair for storytelling, mm-hmm. and that's where he was looking in for movies. So he's just saying, okay, knowing that you need tension and you need something where you want the emotional involvement in some way, that was where he pushed it. And then over the years, he really, he'd come in towards the end of the process, he might have taken a look at a few games, but he really didn't have any input. At the time when we first started the group, and for most of the time I was there, we were not allowed to do anything in the Star Wars universe. And that was because all the licenses for different platforms had already been secured by different companies. So we really couldn't compete against them internally. So it really wasn't until the early 90s when some of those licenses expired that, LucasArts was able to start doing Star Wars games. And at the time I was pretty disappointed because the main reason I went there was because I wanted to find a way to get inside of the Star Wars universe, maybe by making a game or by being involved in some way. And when I found out that was off limits, I was kind of like, what? Are you kidding? The first game I did kind of had a Star Wars inspired feel to it, but it really wasn't in that universe. But then after a few years of coming up with her own stuff, I realized how freeing that was by not having George, carefully looking at what we were doing with his baby, basically.
You got Labyrinth as a film tie-in. And mm-hmm. went to England to meet Douglas Adams.
Well, the Lucasfilm was the movie was produced by Lucasfilm, came out under the Lucasfilm title. So that was really the first time they were saying, hey, do you want to do a game based on this license or this product that we're doing? I think they wanted to kind of test us to see how well we were able to take a movie and adapt it to the game, to a game world. And we thought it would sound like a really good idea. So when we heard that we could do a brainstorming session in England, it was like a week-long series of meetings with Douglas Adams and a guy named Christopher Cerf, who was heavily involved with the Muppets and Jim Henson, who Jim Henson was the director of the movie. We said, wow, this is awesome. Let's do that. So we, a group of us, I think it was like four of us, went there and spent a week. And I was a game designer and project leader on that. And so I was mostly just taking notes and contributing ideas. But I felt so outclassed by by Douglas Adams and his quick wit and humor. And it was, I don't remember if I talked a lot. I was like kind of in awe for at least a few days.
A bit starstruck.
For sure. By that point, I had already read at least one of the, I'm not sure what the, where they were, but I knew his work. I read Hitchhiker's Guide, and I was definitely starstruck. It's ironic since, you know, I could be in a room and talk to George Lucas, but I couldn't be in a room and talk to Douglas Adams. So, and he was, you know, he was so nice and welcoming and everything. It wasn't anything in his attitude. It was just my tongue-tiedness.
Because at the time, loads of games just used, like, you know, a simple text parser, didn't they, for adventure games. And Labyrinth, I think, in my memory, that was one of the first ones I saw where you actually, you know, all adventure games turn out to be like that in the end, but when you selected actions rather than just typing it in. Was that something you wanted to stay away from, just making it purely text-based?
I think it was partly a timing in terms of production schedule. We felt that in order to do a really good text parser, it would just take way too long to do it. I mean, Sierra had already been doing text adventure games with graphic imagery for a while, and to get it to really work well, it just seemed like it was going to be beyond us. So we had the idea of like limiting it. And I think it was my idea to come up with a kind of this, what I was calling a slot machine interface, where you had almost like wheels or strips of verbs and objects that you could choose from. So it would be limited, but it wouldn't be too restrictive. And, you know, it worked. I think it worked. Even in the text adventure part of this, we did that same thing. So we had combinations of text words. So it was kind of like a tutorial or training to get to the next stage. Yeah, when Ron did Maniac Mansion soon after Labyrinth, I think by that point we'd already, you know, seen that restricting it, you know, keeping away from a parser was a good idea. You didn't have a lot of people trying to metagame it by guessing what the programmer had been thinking, what words he was thinking of, and you could be much more focused on the game itself and not, you know, which words to use.
Well, obviously that used the SCUM system, and that kind of became the thing of Legends. I mean, how did the development on that work then? Did that kind of, was it a natural evolution after Labyrinth?
Yeah, well, Brian didn't work on Labyrinth, but I'm not even sure how, we were just talking about this recently. I'm not even sure to what degree he looked at Labyrinth and came up with its inspiration. He said when he and Gary started working on Maniac Mansion, he didn't even know at the time he wanted it to be an adventure game at first. And then, you know, it kind of struck him after he saw some CR games and said, okay, this is the format I want to use. And so it might have been some influence from Labyrinth. And I think mostly it was probably Ron off on his own with Gary coming up with what he thought would work the best. Originally, it wasn't going to be a SCUM system. He was going to hand code everything, which is what we did with Labyrinth. And at some point, I believe Chip Morningstar, who was working on Habitat at the time, suggested that he use, you know, an interpreter and you know, P-code, I think was what he was using. So basically some way where you had a leverage to do a lot more, to do something at a higher level than just hand coding it all. And that probably was what made it possible, because doing Labyrinth was really, really painful, where doing the SCUM scripting was really fun. You know, it's much more like giving directions to the actors on the stage.
Well, SCUM, I mean, it was kind of used until like the mid-90s, wasn't it, at LucasArts? Did you ever envision that it was going to last that long?
No, and we didn't even think that our games would last that long. We figured at the time doing a game would have a life of maybe 1 or 2 years, maybe 3 if we were lucky. And by that point, everyone would have given up those computers and gotten a much better computer, and they wouldn't want to go back to play. You know, they couldn't, I mean, technically they wouldn't even be able to do it, you know, because you can't play a Commodore 64 game on an Amiga, for example. And we figured that was going to be the trend, you know, more and more powerful computers would come out that would not be compatible with previous ones. And we just totally missed the idea of emulators as a possibility that, of course, if they're getting more powerful, then they could literally emulate a much slower computer and have way, you know, and be much faster than the old computers were. I think I wasn't, because I kind of wasn't really involved in gaming from around 93 or 4, probably somewhere 94 to about maybe for about the next 10 years. When I went to in 2004, I went to both the Gathering and Assembly. One was in Norway, the other was in Finland. And that was my first time that I was blown away that people actually knew the games that we had done. they were still playing them, and they're playing them on everything from the current computers to their Nokia cell phones. Commodore 64 emulator on a Nokia phone. It blew me away because I had no connection with this. I had no idea people were still going to even remember the games.
Well, after Maniac Mansion, obviously, the next game to use Scum was Zap McCracken. So where did the idea of that game come from? Because that was quite an interesting concept for a game.
Yeah, well, Maniac Mansion was Ron and Gary's idea, and I was working with them as the primary Scum scripter. Since I already spent a good chunk of time learning the system, it felt like a natural next step to do my own game next on using Scum. And I really wanted to do something that had kind of a new agey, bizarre, otherworldly quality to it. And spent a week, no, actually, maybe it was 2 days, brainstorming with a friend of our general manager's. Steve Arnold was our general manager. He had a friend named David Spangler, who was a spiritualist and wrote books about that whole area. And we just talked about all the different elements we could try to squeeze into the game. And we were definitely doing it from a funny point of view. It was definitely tongue-in-cheek. You know, I had to go back, very similar to Labyrinth, I had to go back home afterwards and look at, you know, pages and pages of notes and figure out how can I turn this into a cohesive story. And a lot of that from the brainstorming worked its way in, kind of got massaged a lot. Then there was a meeting we had with all the designers at Lucasfilm where we talked about how to make it funnier. And Ron felt that it wasn't going to be funny enough the way it was. So we kind of turned it a little bit further in a bizarre direction.
Was it originally quite a serious game then, was it originally?
No, it wasn't at all serious. It just wasn't as wacky. Mm-hmm. It was intended to be kind of more of a dry humor originally. I mean, the whole concept, everything was kind of off kilter, but taking the main character who's originally was named Jason, giving him a more unusual name, which we pulled out of the Marin County phone book, and turning him in from a mainstream reporter from like a major newspaper to a tabloid, totally opened it up in terms of what we could do and how nuts it was. And once we had realized that we said, okay, here's the frame. This is a perfect framework. The tabloid reporting part just kind of freed everything up and put it into a much wackier world.
Well, I've even heard some people kind of, say maybe inspired the X-Files and Zap McCracken's a bit like Fox Mulder. So were you kind of into like UFOs and that kind of thing, conspiracy theories?
I don't know about conspiracy theories that much, but definitely UFOs and, you know, psychic phenomenon and, you know, pretty much everything that was there. I loved the X-Files when it came out because it was like very much like the game. We'd also, for years afterwards, we'd find, you know, people would bring me stories from real tabloid newspapers that were, you know, directly out of the game. Oh my God, you know, this is just like we had in the game. I mean, we did some stuff like, you know, we were looking for conspiracy stuff like, you know, the whole thing with the face on Mars. That was, you know, David Spangler knew about that. I didn't know about that. So we threw some of that in there. We're looking for things, everything we could think of that people have been talking about, like, you know, Elvis in space and all the other things, ancient astronauts and all that. So right. Yeah, I guess I was into that. I don't know if I call it conspiracy stuff as like, you know, kind of far out stuff that most people wouldn't consider.
One thing I particularly remember about LucasArts games was piracy was completely rife in Europe, and none of my friends would have a copy disc of LucasArts because they always had really good copy protection. Yeah.
Well, that's good. I mean, the first two games we did got pirated before they were even published. And we were really sensitive to that.
Yeah, because you must have, there was a lot of innovation in the kind of anti-piracy technology. I remember code wheels from mm-hmm. Monkey Island and stuff like that. I think that was one of the first times I'd seen a code wheel.
Right. You know, I think for each of our games that we self-published, we had something in there which was supposed to be anti-piracy. I mean, it didn't stop it. It just probably punished the people who were buying the game because they had to then stop and look up something on a code sheet or code wheel, and it's probably kind of a pain. I mean, there's a whole sequence I put into Zach McCracken where if you couldn't answer the questions that were presented to you where you didn't need the code sheet, it threw you into pirate jail. And there's a whole new scene with being in jail and then talking to you about not stealing software. It's kind of fun. You can find that on the internet, on YouTube, if you look for it.
It's good they had a bit of a sense of humor about it, though.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we knew that was going to happen anyway. We just kind of wanted people to do it. I don't know if you noticed on Ron's game, the one I'm working on now with Ron on Thimbleweed Park, he had a whole bit where, you know, you could pay $5 extra for the game for, you know, guilt absolution for pirating our earlier games and, you know, make you feel better about it. So a lot of people did that. A lot of people paid the extra $5 to feel like they were absolved of any guilt for having pirated the other games.
Well, a bit earlier on, we did touch on, you mentioned Sierra. Obviously, they were kind of the other big name in adventure games at the time. How much of a rival were they seen internally at Lucasfilm?
From our point of view, they were a pretty huge rival. I think from their point of view, they probably barely knew we were around. In the United States, we'd issue a title and it would sell maybe a fraction of what theirs did in the U.S. In Europe, I think we were doing much better than they did. I don't think they had very good distribution in Europe. So it's interesting. I think most of our fans are from Europe. I mean, there are a bunch of fan-created Zack McCracken sequels and prequels, and they all came from Germany. I think it was because we wanted our games there. We also did a really careful job of translating them to the local languages. And whenever they would come out with a new game, we would look at it and make sure we were on track to be competitive. I remember we were working on Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade and saw a Sierra game and how much animation they were using, that we had not been using much animation yet. So we had to rethink a whole bunch of things and create a whole new animation system to kind of match the level of animated cutscenes that they were using.
Well, speaking of our next big projects, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade was obviously a massive title. So what was it like working on that game then?
As with Labyrinth, we had a hard deadline because we really wanted the game to come out near the time the film was released. But we only had about 6 months. And so Noah Falstein had already started working on the game and realized that it wasn't going to get finished with him just being on it by himself, even with, you know, some programming help. So Steve Arnold asked both me and Ron Gilbert if we could join with Noah in a really high intensity project, get something done. So we decided to use Scum because it was already there and you could do graphic adventure. And it was a push. It wasn't as horrendous as you might think. We actually had a lot of fun doing it. I remember, you know, being able to split up the work and each take different sections, and it felt like a really fun project. We had early scripts. We knew what the story was going to be, so we just had to come up with a way to match the feeling of the story. But we also didn't want people who had seen the movie to have a big advantage over people who hadn't. We probably assumed that everyone who played the game would have already seen the movie by then, but we wanted to be parallel enough so that you could see where the inspiration came from, but it wasn't solving, you know, things from the movie weren't going to solve the game for you. And we had an early meeting with George Lucas and Steven Spielberg, where we just asked for any guidelines they had about what we could and could not do. Like, you know, was it okay if we actually killed Indy off in the game, as if that were what happened? And they said, yeah, sure, you could do that. And we could expand the locations and, you know, we could go as far outside the story as we wanted to. So that was nice to have that freedom, although we didn't go too far away from what was in the movie.
I was going to ask whether there was much kind of crossover with the movie production. Was Spielberg involved much more beyond that point then?
Not really. I think he ended up playing the game before it came out, and he was calling Noah on the phone like every day asking for hints about, you know, what should I do with this? I mean, here's where I am, stuck at this point. So
could have sold him a guidebook.
Yeah, really. Well, we don't think we had the guidebook out yet. We know what Noah was his guidebook. You know, when you have a direct line to one of the designers, it's a lot faster. You know, Steven was actually much more of a gamer than George was. So he was very much into a bunch of our games, and he spent time, you know, actually playing them. And what kind of funny story, much earlier, because there was the, you know, Atari CoinOp had the license for the Atari CoinOp games for Star Wars. And we would get a complete, you know, game system every time they finished one. So we had kind of a room that was set aside for arcade games. And one of the games was a sit down, I think the first Star Wars game that came out, which was the one with the vector, color vector graphics of, you know, going through the Death Star and fighting TIE fighters and all that. And Peter Langston had looked over the manual that came with it, you know, the repair manual, and found that there was a jumper he could add, which would put the game into marketing mode, which was really a way to single step through the frames so the marketing people could take screenshots. And he took a couple of wires from the circuit board, brought it into the console, in the sit down console area, and put a button on it, labeled it the Force. So when you push the Force button, the whole thing would go in, you know, all the action would freeze except for the joystick cursor, which you could then carefully go through and pick off all the TIE fighters on the screen without worrying about them advancing on you.
Genius.
And you push it again, and it would go back into normal mode. And we kind of forgot about that. And then we just do it because it was fun, and we felt it was a cheat, but it was kind of fun to do it that way. And there, I think they were doing the production work on, maybe it was Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. I think it was that film. They were doing a bunch of work in the soundstage, you know, that was adjacent to where we were working. And Steven Spielberg asked if there were any arcade games that they could put over there, you know, that he could play while they were down. Because, you know, in movies, there's a huge amount of time when they're doing setup for the next shot, and it's, you know, probably really boring. So he wanted something to do while they were doing the setup. So we sent that game over and heard the story like half a year later. I guess he really liked the game a lot. So he ordered one for his home or for his office back in Los Angeles. You know, we heard that there was a phone call to Atari when it arrived where he was saying, you know, I got the game, but hey, where's the Force button? And they said, what? What are you talking about? I said, yeah, you're missing the Force button.
Should have come to standard with everyone.
I know, really. It could have been a great marketing thing. And maybe put an extra quarter in to get access to it or something.
So why did you end up leaving in the end?
Well, when I first started there, I told Peter Langston, then when Steve Arnold came over as the general manager, I told him that what I really wanted to be doing was the Disneyland stuff, you know, the interactive theme park, or the much more, the term by that point became location-based entertainment. And, you know, that doing games for homes was okay, but I really wanted to do something that was much more immersive. And, you know, I was told, yeah, well, that's all well and good, but right now we're doing home games. Around 1990, you know, Steve Arnold was also really interested in the idea of doing something like location-based entertainment. And we were growing pretty fast and needed to be much more of a, you know, I think at that point we had like maybe 60 or 70 people in the group. It was going to expand to like 100 and something. And it was pretty much everyone was reporting to Steve Arnold. We didn't have separate groups set up. So he asked me to, you know, for a year to stop doing games and become the director of operations and try to create more of a flatter, hierarchical type of reporting structure where, yeah, like maybe we have a head of the art department, head of quality assurance, head of customer support. And one of my jobs was to find people for those positions and also to kind of be the person who was managing all the programmers and designers, and just so it wasn't all on him. I did that. I didn't especially like that because it wasn't creative in the same way that doing games is creative. And he knew that wasn't what I wanted to do. So he kind of made a deal with me that said, if you do that for a year, then get someone to replace you, we can start a new group to do some kind of location-based entertainment project. So that's pretty much what happened. I did it for a year, and then we started a new group called Rebel Arts and Technology, which was really outside of LucasArts, that was focused on doing more immersive types of experiences. And the first one, the big one we were working on, was called the Mirage. And it was a joint venture with Hughes Simulation. That's Hughes Aircraft. It's a company that was building flight simulators that the airlines and the military were using. So they knew a lot about simulators, but they didn't know anything about games. So they were going to do the technical aspects of it, and we were going to do the design and the creative part of it. And that was, you know, blast. So we ended up building a prototype. It was supposed to be multiplayer. You're going to have 8 of these pods that could play together in the same universe. And I actually got to create a Star Wars game. We have permission to do that. And you're flying a TIE fighter or an X-Wing and flying around this planet. I got to work with Orson Scott Card, the author, who had been doing some consulting with us by that point. And he helped me with some of the story aspects of the concepts I was coming up with. Yeah, it was a blast to play it. And you know, it's had a lot of fun, you know, doing that project. And then, unfortunately, Steve Arnold, who is the big champion for that, left to go work for Bill Gates and start up a new group for him. And there really wasn't anyone high enough up at Lucasfilm who cared about the project. And so they ended up backing away from it, closing down our group, and, you know, basically selling or giving the rights to Hughes to do what they wanted to with it. At that point, I just left because I couldn't imagine going back and doing games when I had a taste of something fully immersive. You know, imagine sitting in a cockpit with a 120-degree field of view scene of what you're flying through and high-end, you know, simulator graphics, you know, something way better than you could do with computers at the time. Just, you know, just such a cool experience.
Well, we know you're working at the moment on Thimbleweed Park with Ron Gilbert. Did you manage to play any of the Monkey Island games?
Well, I think Monkey Island, the first Monkey Island game was in production while I was the director of operations. So I probably have a credit on that one as director of operations. The second one, I think I might have been doing the Mirage project at that point, but I did play it and really liked it a lot. The ones after that, I played a little bit, but it didn't grab me in the same way. So yeah, Monkey Island was probably one of my favorite games. And the idea of working with Ron and Gary again was just like, you know, and I wasn't sure at first whether we could just fall in and just do it, and whether, you know, 25 years later, would that be too much to actually try doing this again? And, you know, happily, it worked out really well. It felt really natural. Like after a couple minutes of just brainstorming, it was like, oh yeah, I remember this. This is the best part of being at Lucas, was working with creative people like this and coming up with really fun ideas. So we're still deep in production, and you know, the target is to have it out by beginning of 2017, and hopefully we'll be on target. We're going to be at PAX West in early September, which is in Seattle, and I'm going to go there myself. I'll be there along with Ron. I'm not sure if Gary's going, and it's really fun. It's a really fun game.
If people want to find out a bit more about it, is there anywhere they can go to?
Go to thimbleweedpark.com. There's a website there. There's also a blog that Ron keeps up. There's usually a new post at least once or twice a week. We do a podcast every couple weeks, Ron, Gary, and I, where we talk about where we are at production. And so because it was a Kickstarter-based, you know, funded game, there's a, you know, large following of people who are involved and interact with us on the message boards or on the discussions after the blog. And, it, you know, it's really fun to, you know, it's something that I never had as an experience while we were doing our games back at Lucas, where we actually have contact with the with our audience. I mean, even after the games came out, I'd barely hear anything from anyone. And here it's like constant feedback and interaction, both on the blog and social media. And that's really fun.
Without giving away, obviously, any spoilers, will there be a bit of that, you know, lots of that Lucas magic in there?
Oh, yeah. It's 100% Lucas magic, except it's updated and, you know, takes into consideration everything that we've learned in the last 25 years about games. And so I think hopefully it'll be even more fun.
Well, David, there's not many guys we've had on the show where, you know, probably half of our top 10 favourite games of all time they'd be behind. So we really appreciate you coming on this week and taking the time to talk to us.
Good. Well, maybe after Thimbleweed is out, we should get Albus on the show or something.
Oh, absolutely. We'd love that.
Yeah, that would be amazing. Maybe we could get you and Ron on and do a freeway like podcast if we could.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, David. Really enjoyed that.
Okay, thank you.